Deezer Originals.
Wherever you are, whenever you are, welcome to Talk Stew. Now, you could say that I'm pretty cocky, bordering on confident, at the fact that I have fantastic friends, so much so that the conversations we have, I find formative, to the point that I've decided to share those conversations with you. Now, the only downside of that is that those conversations might be incredibly entertaining, or they could be fucking boring. Today, it's up to you to decide which one they actually are. Welcome to Talk Stew, and joining me for the gumbo of conversation are two very important, you might say cheap or discounted ingredients. They come in the shape of Owen Cutts.
Hi.
Is that it? Did we not get anything else?
Well, you said I was cheap. The lead-up wasn't great for me.
Okay, sorry about that. And fresh from the bargain bucket, Kevin McPherson.
The bargain bucket?
This is what I'm saying.
Did you just do a black thing, like a chicken, your bargain bucket, kind of like a chicken thing, straight off. Yeah,
It's cheap and then...
It went cheap and chicken. Cheap and
chicken. The irony is, I'm actually vegetarian, so...
Wow, okay.
I'm just slightly confused with that, but anyway, all right.
You've heard his voice.
Yeah.
Our special guest, who is neither cheap and chicken nor in the bargain bucket, it's none other than Goldie.
It's been a bit of a mad one. I'll tell you what, seeing you young mans them come up really hard on me, I'm not really feeling that in my rearview mirror right now. My man's on some takeover team, like, yeah, you just put a foot down. Yes, it was amazing. Yes, and the SLR just coming up like, hard on your shoulder.
Hang on a second.
Man.
So, what are you saying? Are you saying that this generation of people in the business are moving quicker than yours?
I think it's beautiful to watch that because. That's kind of why, you know, when we look at these things, and it's really, I love the idea of breaking down conventional radio and how podcasts reach out there and, you know, live feed and everything else to what it really is, because that's the truth. But it really is beautiful to watch that, especially when you look at the grime thing, how that's accelerated now. It has been the voice as opposed to the humming resonance where no one could quite work out what rave culture was because it's the sound resonating. D&B was a tricky wild style to deal with if you don't understand graffiti. Telling it like it is, how it's going down in the verbalisation of what's going on is wicked. It's seeing you doing all... I mean, some of the programmes you've been doing have been quite prolific.
I appreciate that.
And I'm like, someone that speaks the same language! Finally!
I'm so glad that you're here because there are so many things that we can tackle. We can talk about music, art, identity, so many different things. And I think one of the best things about having you here at this time is that you've got a book coming out which kind of tackles a lot of the things that I'd like to get into today. So I imagine they're fresh in your mind.
Yeah, I mean, I've always been fresh in my mind. It's whether or not the water underneath the water's being carried to the top sometimes. And that's what really it is. I think the great thing about being here now at 52 is realising I know very little about life. And placing myself in Thailand in a place where no one knows me.
Is that home for you now?
It's so home. I mean, it's been home for 10 years. I mean, it's been...
I did not know that.
Yeah, yeah.
What part of Thailand?
I'm in Phuket, in a village called Kamalap.
Are you saying that you don't have a home here in the UK anymore?
I have a home in the UK.
Right.
I'm very patriotic. I've always loved this country.
Yeah.
I have a really strong viewpoint about the latency of local government and general government. Because I don't want it to be I'm throwing stones from the glass house. Even I'm misunderstood by a new generation of people going, you know what? I'm like that boy, you know. But actually, it's actually talking some sense because we don't know. We have all this connection with the internet, but we're not connected at all.
Do you know what?
We know very little about stuff.
This is one of the things I love about this platform is that we can dive straight into conversation and we can go anywhere with it. But it would be remiss of me as I guess the host of this thing, if you will, to not actually give any time to the fact that you might be listening to this for the first time. This is Talk Stew, and it's not just myself and Goldie here. I have two of my very good friends sat either side of me, and we should probably give you a bit more context as to not only why they're here, but who they are. So, Mr. Owen Cutts, this isn't your first time here on Talk Stew. It might be worth you sort of boiling down as best you can as to who you are, and maybe the way, not so much you see the world, but the way in which you believe you'll attack today's subject matter.
I'm Owen Cutts. I'm a songwriter, producer. And how am I going to tackle today? I think I want to know, especially having Goldie here, who's like a legend in the sort of like music. I mean, you've done a lot of things, but interestingly, you said before how the rave culture wasn't quite coming through. And now the grime culture is, that kind of sparked something in my mind as to like, maybe why. Now we have the internet.
Things are different, yeah.
Things are different. Like, why is it coming through now and it didn't come through then?
Oh, it came through, but it was such an underground thing. I mean, it was just, without interrupting you, it just came through. I saw the same thing with New York. It was, all these trains were being painted by people that were Somali and Haitian, Afro, black, but they all said the same thing. It was Walsall, a letter form in colour. Mm. I don't know what it says and what it means, but it just, it meant energy. It meant people have got nothing to do. Whereas the rave culture is this sound. It was the sound of coming on the back of punk. It was this sound that had took from African-American, you know, Detroit techno, black techno, I must say, that came from Detroit, that came to make it here in Europe, and everyone else got paid. And all of a sudden, this resonance of rave culture was misunderstood by the world, man, like big time. Because we're in fields. We didn't want, you put me on a cover in like the early 90s, it was seen as being damn up disrespectful. You can't be on a front cover. And that's what it's like. I mean, for you growing up, what was your, you know, in an English UK kid coming up, rave culture is part of your life.
Completely. Totally. I had a strange upbringing where I was like middle class, really nice area, good bunch of friends, played cricket to quite a high level and just had that life until I went to secondary school where it was like,
man, damn.
Shit. It was like dodging, getting robbed. And basically, my school, you couldn't listen to Blur or Oasis. It was drum and bass and it was hip hop. And it was, it was smoking weed and it was going down Camden getting a telepathy pack.
Telepathy.
Like, too young to go to the raves, but getting...
That's the thing that's so... It's such a shame that that's missing now. Like, there is a generation of kids that don't know the power of a tape pack.
Mad.
Having...
To Mickey Finn roast fifth birthday bash tape.
Oh, my God.
Seriously, Roast was... for those of you who don't know, there was a few really underground clubs. And we're talking when it was, you know, predominantly urban black, where it was Roast was for the older guys. It was where ravers who knew the guys who were playing would go out and it would be like... Girl from around the ends would go get her hair did and announce that and got a roast.
I wish I could have gone.
It was, I mean, roast was the older, it was a little bit like how you'd see, I sometimes see a party happening. It's like a, you know, a Nigerian street party with some people in a club somewhere, you know, coming up somewhere. It was a different lick.
It was a subculture.
Subculture existed.
But it's so nice to hear it because in my head, I was too young to go.
Yeah.
So we were just listening to these tapes.
Yes.
Yeah, someone parked their Ford Fiesta outside, you know, and the MC was telling them to move it. So I never knew.
By the way, I had a Fiesta.
It was red.
It was often moved. No, I actually had Doc Scott Sierra 2.0.
Wow.
I bought it from Coventry. Enough times outside Paradise Club, and I say, yo, you got to move the car. No. I remember coming out of Paradise Club without going down the track here. If any of you guys out there, old Paradise Club, Islington, GQ, famous MC on the scene for a long time. GQ MC was Kenny Ken drops down, doing back to back with Randall, smash it up, come out there, morning light. Where's my car gone? You know, BMW's gone. I mean, those days, I think the take back education, there was a big thing on Twitter the other week about... This guy said, God, I've known you for 25 years. You know, why can you say that, you know, Americans don't understand rave culture? Well, like we don't understand Jane's Addiction as much. Because culturally, going to a rave at Donington Park...
Yeah, it's different.
It's a different thing, man. Yeah.
And there's nothing like it. There's no equivalent in the States to...
They think that EDM, you know, going out to a big rave, going to a big festival... And that's the thing. My friend runs... You know, Pasquale Rotterdale, he does EDC, massive, huge, owns Vegas, literally now. Mm. Big raves, big thing. And I'm like, I get it.
I wouldn't even call them raves, because it's not the same thing.
It's too organised and it's too slick. And that was the thing about, I mean, I'm a little bit older than him, so I actually caught, my first raves were like Club Labyrinth in Hackney.
Can I hold both of you at the same time? I mean, you got Plumstead Labyrinth, I'm at the owner.
Roller Express,
Laser Drum.
Right.
So I'm
a little bit older than maybe I people would guess, but I was 14,
not
15.
Not without facial hair.
Each other? Are you friends from the past?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You've grown up around the ends together.
Yeah. All right.
We were explaining that.
I need you to finish this story 1,000,000%, but before you do, maybe you can explain a little about who you are and how long we've known each other.
I've known you for too long, quite frankly. No, I'm a producer, writer, musician guy, and... I guess my path of music is kind of, it started off in happy hardcore, then going into sort of jungle and drum and bass, then into R&B and hip hop, and then into, I suppose, traveling abroad and working with people in Los Angeles.
Mm.
And then finally kind of coming back here and sort of getting more into the compositional side. Yeah. So in essence, I'm trying to kind of follow this guy in some respects in terms of the sort of the filmic composition side.
Because now you're scoring.
Yeah, like I'll score short films and TV shows and stuff. But the funny thing is, a lot of people, when I tell them my first ever release was a Happy Hardcore record, they look at me like, what?
What's Happy Hardcore? Yeah,
yeah, exactly. But, what's your relationship then with breakbeat, with drum and bass, and with the music of this man?
This is the funny thing. So I was 14. The first raves I was going to, Club Labyrinth. I remember seeing Prodigy when they were called Cut to Kill.
Cut to Kill, yeah.
Like the very very first live Club Labyrinth was Four Aces in Hackney. And then the regular sort of night out was a place
Knowledge.
Called... Not even Knowledge. That was a
memory.
Night as well. There was a place called Roller Express in Edmonton, which was a roller rink.
It was the first big one.
Yeah, the first really big one.
It was
one.
The
Did
first big one.
Did you put skates one? On?
No,
close that thing, yeah.
For the purpose of this, can we pretend that you were on skates? Because I like the visual.
I like you guys on skates.
It's the first time I smelled Vicks really strongly. Apart from Shelley's nightclub, Vicks. Because everyone's giving people massages with Vicks. You know that?
Of course I did. I remember that.
Wait,
guys.
Not like that.
Let's not disassociate. Yeah, China Brush with Vicks, yeah, for a start.
But hang on a second.
It's true. You don't even know Rave Culture Blood. You don't even know it. You know what I'm leaving. You know what I mean? You say, I'm talking about Rave, like, tape pack. Get inside the tape pack, yeah? That's what it was. Yeah. People would be getting Vicks and things to kind of want to, because they couldn't breathe.
So hang on a second. So when you listen to the right drum and bass record, you get like the smell of Tiger Balm fill your nose?
Not really. I'll get a bit wobbly on my nose. That's what I mean. Now, it was like that. Yeah. I mean, Rhino Express Wicked. I did my first... second PA at Roller Express with a keyboard that wasn't even plugged in doing Terminator on One New Year.
Was I there? I might have even been there.
It was Reinforced Records doing a PA. Yeah. Mannix and Ruffage Crew, that's what it was.
I think I may well have been
probably
there.
Probably was. And
Jesus
The thing about rave culture is that no one cared if it wasn't plugged in.
No, they were too high.
They were like that lead's going nowhere.
Somewhere.
Mate, look, we've got this book in front of us now, and I'm so chuffed that you've written a second book, because I was a fan of yours, and I obviously came to your music a lot later than someone like Kevin did. Mm-hmm. And I came to you around the Timeless album, Inner City Life, obviously that massive record and that massive moment, being the age that I am, that was when you first hit my radar. But then in my late teens, early 20s, I believe it was, maybe a little later, you released your first book, which was pretty
Nine
much...
Lives, yeah.
Yeah, it was pretty much a biography, and it went into the detail of who you were, who you are, and who you hope to become, essentially. And I had no idea, as a massive fan of graffiti, that you were that guy. Because I own Subway Art.
Oh, God,
and I used to draw all the stuff in Subway Art. Like, what's it? I always pronounce it wrong. Vaughan Bode, the artist.
One of my
favorite artists. And you were in there alongside people like him. And as a kid, I used to draw and copy your artwork. Because there's like two or three pieces of yours in Subway Art. But the book that came after...
Spray Can Art. That's the one I was in. Yeah.
That's the one that actually has your portrait in it, and you're a young guy with short hair standing in front of some of your work.
And it's with a guy called Henry Chalfont, who, weirdly enough, in my world of knowledge, which I seem to have had all of a sudden now, Henry Chalfont was partnered with David Silver and Martha Cooper, who published that book, all the photographs.
Yeah.
The producer actually made a documentary, David Silver, called Style Wars. For anyone that's... Style Wars is really important.
It's the Bible.
It's the Bible of that. Amazing. Now, what's really beautiful about it is I chased everyone in that book, found them, hung out with them.
Pre-internet.
And interviewed them, yeah.
Wow. So what's your take then when it comes to this second wave of street art, if you will, becoming mainstream? Because obviously you're part of that first generation of street artists and the graffiti culture that came from New York and took over the world. Mm. And then in, mid-90s, early noughties, street art in its more stencil
aspect, Banksy
became mainstream.
Yeah, so, I can explain it very easily.
How were you guys able, like, how did you sort of look at that scene as it
very
as it
easily, in the same way that a lot of people within the music industry kind of, I remember standing outside Camden with a record called Terminator waiting for Jazzy B to give it to him.
Amazing.
Jazzy never understood it, but I know it was being, for me, it was being honourable for the genre of what taught me everything I know. Because Nelly was one of my best friends. I watched Nelly in the studio. I watched Harry B, you know, record U2 and record, you know, when Move a Mountain was being done, I was at Utopia Studios just watching these guys, you know, like, wow.
Hmm.
This is, you know, when Harry was at Mayfair working the night shift, just was just laying down his record. What's the connection? Well, the connection is that, you know, seeing all those first time generation graffiti writers, you kind of forget what they laid down for you.
Right.
Third rail, getting killed, mum's on PCP, on acid, people getting shot in the yards. The yards the police couldn't go to. because it was like, that's where you go to have it.
Yeah.
Mm. And Subway Art, unbeknown to me, was written. All of the main paintings in that book, there was two summers where New York Transit was on strike and the yards were free for all.
Wow.
Literally, it's like me walking into the New Cross Yard right now in a holiday at the peak of summer and no one don't give a fuck if I'm painting or not.
That's amazing.
And we kind of get this thing about, you know, we've got to get caught, not getting caught, all that kind of stuff. But there was a period where some of those great pieces that got done was because it just got on top for a lot of people. The city was on fire. The Bronx was on fire.
Yes.
And the point I'm making is that, you know, when these new artists came around, I just have these words of a famous critic called Josie Frycourt going through my head. You know, art, graffiti, he says the barbarians from within will take over the art form as we know it. And this was in 1972 at an art fair. The barbarians from within will take over. And the art is the application of a medium to a surface. Man, to Mike spitting.
Yeah.
You know, street culture is the barbarian that just has raised its ugly head. And that's the monster that everyone tried to beat down, which this boy that they beat that became a man. When you think about it, you know, and if you try and remove graffiti from society, like remove it, middle-class people going to work would be going, something's missing.
Yeah.
you know, generally, in general, because all of a sudden my kid's not, where's your hat gone? Where's them nice shiny trainers I bought you the weekend? Mm. That's part of street culture too, love. Or man, you know what I mean? Like all of street culture stuff, we all take it from the source and we forget. We don't see the line. We don't see it. We have this internet, but we can't connect it.
Yeah.
We just press buy and we get it online. It just gets delivered by Amazon. No disrespect. It's great. I love it. But it is the velvet claw, all of that stuff. Street culture and seeing that happen where Big Brother's watching. So the time becomes narrower. People become smarter because culture does what it says on the tin. It will adapt to its environment.
Yeah. Yep.
I know, man, I can tell you this now. Within 2 years in this country, and all 3 years, right? I ain't the Dalai Lama here, kid. But I've said this with a few things that I've seen happen. People will be hacking billboards with their computers.
Yeah,
and you'll see fuck you wherever it is, whatever they're trying to be against. Because that's my phone ringing and I didn't turn it fucking off.
That's the man.
That's my phone's
ringing. The man's hacking.
The man's hacking my phone right now.
That's happened already.
Trust it to be Clint Dyer, the famous director and my mentor on the phone.
Put him on loudspeaker.
You're on speakerphone on a live podcast with Reggie Yates. Say hello.
Hello, everybody.
Hey.
Can you squeeze... Hey, you know, this man, you got to say, we were just talking about mentors.
Yeah.
This is Clint Dyer.
Clint, you're not going to get paid a fee for being on this, by the way.
Then I'm hanging up.
you need to get him on the show. Clint, we're going to meet later on. I'm going to be in town.
You didn't get my text.
We're not doing it. We're tomorrow.
Clint, he's working. What are you having a chat for?
See, love you. Call you later, boss. I love you. This is why we do this podcast. You wouldn't get that in an organised situation.
Whoa. This is not disorganised. We may not have a toilet.
Yeah, I know.
There may not be any paint on the walls. There may not be heaters.
There's no front door.
There's no front door.
I'm looking right outside.
But this is organised, damn it.
This is organised chaos.
Some of the stuff that you've just said, I could put on a t-shirt because it's that incredible. You just went into the most incredible monologue I think I've ever heard, ever. And I have to ask you about expression and art, because what you've said about art and street culture and culture in general to me is huge. But you've chosen so many different mediums to express yourself. And as someone who has written his first book and is expressing himself in the written word for public consumption for the first time, it's quite a scary thing to put myself out there in that way. Now, I obviously want to talk to you about acting. I want to talk to you about your music. We haven't even got to your music yet, but
I know.
As somebody who put himself out there in a book, how scared were you of sharing that much of yourself?
I picked up this thing that you said. I was in Africa. This is the back of Reggie's book that you guys need to go out there and get this book. It's Reggie Yates, Unseen, my journey, you know, and you know, my album like a couple of months ago, it's called The Journey Man, because you know, it's about the journey.
Right.
This is the back of Reggie's book, and the point I'm going to make and bring it all around to a rhetorical thing. At this stage of my career in factual filmmaking, I was green. I felt the weight of responsibility in terms of getting the series right. I was in Africa. I was fronting the first series with my name in the title, and I couldn't fuck it up. Right. There are five things that light up here with a green light, everyone, that you need to understand in bold letters. Green, weight, Africa, name, and fuck. You know, there's a due diligence within Reggie's own subconscious that having ownership of who you are. I'm Reggie Yates, man. Like, I'm owning this already, but I'm coming up and I'm 30-something. But you know what? I just feel this responsibility. If I don't want to fuck this up, you know, because there's a lot of people behind me. And we've seen people fuck up. Mm. We've seen some heroes fall. We've seen people we love get turned the other way.
Right.
Mm. I've been on the edge, man. Like, well, you couldn't speak to me 15 years ago because I got all the money in the world. You know, when the power comes, it's when the power comes, guys. We forget about the integrity.
Mm.
I've done it, you know, where I'm about, you know, I've kind of kept myself in this place. And it's really interesting with your story about LA, you know, I got a phone call, you know, from Madonna. She fell out with Nelly and she's about to go to William Orbit. And
I'm in between,
Nelly Hooper. She's like, yo, man, I really want you to do my album. I'm going to fly out of Love Timeless. It's fantastic. It was so cool.
So what era is this we're talking about?
This is 97, 98.
Got it.
98. And I'm said, no, I'm making Mother. It was the second difficult album. It was a piece of music which is 60 minutes long. It's called Mother.
And you were delivering that arguably after a classic in Timeless.
I was dealing certified. After they wanted Timeless 2 and I'm making Mother.
Right.
And if you guys want to go out and watch Saturn's Return, the answer's in that without drabbing on about this. But the bottom line is you have a choice and you've made these choices, Reggie. And in the book, you've got, there's another thing, conversation about crime and knife crime in schools, which I see about, you know, violence. It's like you said, it just happens. Everyone can't get away from it. Mm. Now, some people reading that can go, that don't happen in Cambridge. It don't happen in wherever. Yeah, because you've come through this thing on your journey. And what makes it special is how far away that is, but how prousty into your memory.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
How far away was that moment in that book there when you were, just to answer me that question, when you were in school and you were getting this thing, you were seeing people get messed up, fucked up.
Yeah.
You know, so you're doing the right thing, but I think people's choice now. And the only advice I can give you is just, as even Winston Churchill apparently said it, is, you know, when you're going through hell, just keep going.
We've all heard
that in some terms.
Yeah,
and we don't know what it is when we're doing it. And I think that it's what we learn from another generation. You said it earlier at the beginning.
As someone who's expressed himself in so many different lanes, how important was the book to you and your form of self-expression? Because Owen, you know, you write songs. That's how you express your innermost. Kevin, you write songs as well, but in a different way.
I think songwriting's poetry. I know. Did you get poetry before the songs?
Did I get it or did I do it?
Because people just go, you know, these words got to rhyme together. I could never spit.
Mm.
But I was always trying to write poetry, but I couldn't make it work in a melodic way.
Yeah. I came from the musical. So I'm not so much about the lyrics.
Music, okay, programming, everything else, okay.
I'm from that side.
I think I'd
be the geek in the studio.
Right.
I think I came from, when I was about 11 and hip-hop, I heard hip-hop for the first time. I just was like, this is insane.
This is it.
Yeah, this is it. And it took my life over and it hasn't let go.
I think the important thing is to see how, you know, we look at some of the fabrication that's happened within the genre that we love.
Yeah.
And people go, there was a lamenting to go to the 80s and how true it was. You know, if you look at Made in America, great documentary, you look at, the crack documentary about how crack stops, you know, rap music. It was about the struggle.
Mm. Mm.
And I think losing face to that struggle within the arts is a very difficult one to gamble with. That's the juggle which a lot of people are faced with. And I think there's a thing where there's no right or wrong in all of this. If you want to listen, I'm a great lover of pop music if it's popular and you write a really good song that comes from the heart.
Mm.
But I think the industry is, let's just do another one because I like it like that.
Well, there's a reason why we have the world, the music business. And, you know, music has unfortunately now become a commodity in much the same way that McDonald's is or Nike is. Or, do you know what I mean? Like
they're literally just
so basically, guys.
No, you're right.
Guys like you, in terms of the integrity, are unfortunately a dying breed because people see the end result. They see the fame and the money, and that's the bit they go for.
As somebody who works with young artists, what are you seeing coming? And this, I put this to you as well, Owen, because you both work with young singer songwriters.
Mm-hmm.
What are you seeing coming through the door in terms of attitude towards expression and towards making music now?
Well, this is what I'll say, and I think you guys can agree with me on this. When we started doing music, nobody ever got into music to get famous.
Right.
Ever. Yeah. That was never
the thing.
That was never the thing. It wasn't even in your conscious sort of horizon. Now what happens is I work with certain people who still have it. They still have that desire and they just have to get things out as this man and yourself and we all have. But more and more, because of the culture of, you know, I call it the Kardashian culture, if you want. Yeah. It's like people see that life and they want that life. As you've said to me before, there's always small print that comes with that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you run the risk of losing yourself if you do have the success, but you're not prepared to deal with it. And some people, as you said earlier, they get lost to that.
Yeah, what do you see, Us?
I see, more often than not, I think everyone starts in the same place. Mm. So when I'm working with a young artist or when I was a young artist, we all start in the same place and we want to carry on. We want to go and we want to do our own thing and we're not going to do that. And we're going to do it how we want to do it. And then, so everyone journeys along in the same way. And then they'll get to a point where they're either offered something or it hasn't quite worked for them. So maybe another angle or getting where you fit in.
Change who they are.
But then there's someone like yourself or other people who just go, no. Yeah, I'm carrying on. I know what I'm doing.
Mm.
And then there's always a struggle for an artist like that where maybe you have a big success and then you need to follow it. Or maybe you have a small success and then you build on it. But if you keep going, then the cream will rise to the top. Yeah. I always believe that.
It sounds to me as though integrity is a huge part of not only what's defined you, but what you look for in the sort of artist that 100%. You work with. So how much has music defined who you are? How much of a part has it played?
Well, it's
how much
of a part has it played in who you are? I'm annoyed at myself almost for never living abroad or like just going to Paris and learning French or whatever. Mm. But music kept me in London, you know. I thought, I can't not be in London. I have to be
around
music.
What is
it
about London and music? Or London music specifically?
I just felt like hip-hop, especially in the sort of like late 90s when I was sort of into it, it just felt like it was happening in London. I mean, and now looking back on it, it was a small little culture that kind of people were involved in and everyone enjoyed, but it never really went anywhere else. You know, like Skinny Man, Task Force, Jess, that kind of thing.
London rap,
but when you were in it, it's everything.
I'm going Kung Fu, man. You don't know about Kung Fu.
You don't know about Kung Fu, Camden.
Yeah, but I think about Silver Bullet, I think about Bionic, NRB, and then man that was doing stuff on the back of, you know, I was coming out early, Shaw Theatre and Cookie Crew and all those early guys. Because we were emulating American kind of Americans and everything else.
Right, yeah,
and
right,
of course that was always gonna be there for a moment, and there's always the true believers of that of the culture generally. But then he moves on and all of a sudden I still think It's really complex because it's a casting as well. You've got to wait for London's cast to fall apart and the hood to be there for it to really become... Because Paris, believe me, had hip-hop way before we did. You know why? Because the precincts were alive and they were ghetto way before. Mm. To the point where it was even in their own dialect.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Solo One was... I used to go to some parties, man, in Paris thinking, right, so Armenian, you know, Algerians, and it's like, and they're going off. In French on the mic, and it's a hip hop jam, and I'm like, rah.
Was it Science Super Crew?
It's mad. But I think there's a big difference that we don't have club culture. It's dying very quickly.
I think it's dead.
It's pretty much dead.
I think it's dead.
It's dead. And I think club culture, if it's done all of these things, if you think about how powerful New York 80s rappers, the influence on the world, and how powerful drum bass music has, at the end, was and is, it doesn't really matter. The impact of grime now in America is huge. The impact of these American guys going, I'm sick of the kind of fabricated stuff. Why do we like that? Why is Pharrell going, I love this track. Mm. I love this guy.
Yeah.
Well, it's because they see this, they're seeing the thing that they've lost sight of in a lot of ways, in a lot of respects.
Yep.
I'm not saying the roots, because the roots always kept real. But it's just how that is. And I think this new generation, thank fuck for grime in that sense of like, finally, these guys can just lay it fucking down for a few summers. It's going to be whatever it is. It'll be someone else and something I never saw before beyond drum and bass. I thought there's nothing else can happen after this. Mm. That's, you know, don't trust your ignorance, sunshine, because that'll soon have you on your toe. But I did realise with Echoes magazine, all the people say, yo, it's going to happen. This country's going to blow.
Yeah.
Because now those hoods are now being pushed out of Brixton, being pushed further out. There's going to be some other shit going on. Mm. New projects going to get built. New sounds going to come out of it.
We've spoken a lot about expression and authenticity, and it's come up on this show before and it will keep coming up. And that's the idea of how we translate our ideas and what form those ideas actually take. And I love the fact that you've operated, Goldie, in so many different mediums and so many different lanes. And film is the one that I'm really fascinated by and would love to talk to you more about,
please.
Because
as my favorite
well, you know, I started out as an actor. That's how I started. Mm-hmm. And then I went into presenting, and from that lots of other things came, and you first came onto my radar as a musician and this sort of enigma almost, because at that time it was difficult to find out much about performers and musicians and artists. Mm. And you were just this really cool character who had this incredible music. And then I think it was in the late 90s, suddenly you were in James Bond. And it was like, hang on. So how did you go from being this guy that was an enigma into arguably one of the biggest franchises of all time? How does that happen?
Serendipity is a beautiful thing. I just connect with people. I was just, my friends, God bless them. You know, Statham's been a friend for years. He's like, you know, he came out to Thailand and he's like, yeah, I'm just going to do this shark movie for like a ridiculous amount of money. And I'm going to do it because I love doing it and I can. And I'm just, he's telling me stories of him, you know, with these crazy guys and doing crazy stuff. And I just fell into things like all these Stevie G, you know, he's out there with Scorsese. He's about to do this biggest movie of his life. I mean,
is it The Irishman he's working on?
He's just in, it's mad stuff is going on. Yeah. It's another thing that, but it's all these wonderful things happening. When I was coming up, there wasn't many people that were doing stuff like that. And I just thought, I saw certain things like Empire Road and I was like, wow, I wonder if I could ever do something like that. This is how fate is the weirdest thing. There's a TV documentary called 7 Up.
Yes, okay. For anyone that doesn't know, that's a documentary where they film these kids age 7 and then they revisit them every 7 years.
Oh, 7 years. Yeah. 7 Up.
They're now in their 50s, right?
Yeah, and the director of that movie was Michael Apted.
Right.
And Michael Apted was asked to do Bond. And Michael Apted went to film school with Dick Fontaine, who did Bombing with me and Gus Coral.
No way.
And he's just weird. And he said, do you think Goldie will come in here? Do you think Goldie might be able to speak Russian? I went, of course I can speak Russian.
What was your bad guy name?
It was Bullion, the Bullion. Yeah, it was the Bullion. Yeah, it was the Bullion. And it was a great, I mean, it was one of the most surreal experiences you can ever have. We're out in Denham and Spain and there's got this water tank. Now, I always associate things. Semi-final, United, Arsenal, kicks his goal, halfway line, runs across the line, scores that ridiculous goal.
We don't talk about that.
We don't talk about that. We're goodness, about that mate.
Yeah, I know you are. That's why I thought I'd stick it in.
We don't talk about that goal.
Fuck that goal. That goal was the best goal. And
his chest air looks shit.
Yeah, his chest air looks shit.
He mugged himself.
Yeah, we mugged you off. 2-1, right?
He ruined the goal.
2-1.
Edit.
Right? And that was when we met Bond, because we was on the set when that happened. I was listening to it in the trailer. I'll never forget it. Because I ran out on the set. And they went, Goldie, you've just ruined Robbie Coltrane's biggest scene. Well, they're cutting a BMW in half. And I'm like, yes, United! Yes! Yes! And they were like, who is that? It's Goldie! Oh, just stop him now! Robbie Coltrane's disgusted.
Stop him now.
Yeah, it was one of those really moments.
Actually scared of you, but pissed
off. Yeah, couldn't really say anything
someone,
to me.
Someone else stop him.
Someone else stop him.
Goldie then. Okay, well, just send him to pipe down a little bit. So it was that moment, and it was that moment, and it was being on the set where they had divers inside this like tank as big as that building there, which is about 45 foot, right? And it's in this tank, all these divers and... Bring another car along. We'll chop another one in half. You know, they bring another BMW up for the scene.
Nuts.
And they just, you know, gave me this suitcase and says, you've got this bomb in there. You've got to plant it. You've got to be scared and all this other stuff. And, you know, I've got all the scripts and stuff. And it was just an amazing moment.
Was that one of the biggest pinch me moments? Because I imagine you've had a few in your career.
Yeah.
Where you sort of stop and you go, hang on, I'm here. Was that one of them?
I think probably one of the biggest ever, because it's all over the place in this book, actually, was... Speaking to Ted Turner in Chateau Mau Mau, where Belushi OD'd with Val Kilmer with a room full of candles, and Josh Evans, Robert Evans, he's my best friend, Robert Evans, his son, Josh Evans, he's my best friend, weirdly enough. He's been my friend for years. And we made a pact we cut each other, we made a pact years ago.
A blood pact?
Yeah, blood pact. We're right there, there's a scar right there. And we were Hyena 1, Hyena 2. And he lives in Nevada desert, believe it or not, watching spacecraft take off regularly. And we talk about life. We just get to this place on this rock and we just, so what else has happened, brother, in the last 20 years? You know, we talk about all this stuff that's happened, which has been realised. Because back then we're like the pharaohs, you know, controlling everything, the power, you know, watching all the ants, building everything. And I'm on the phone, you know, we're talking about Timeless. Because I always wanted to make the film Timeless was always has always been in script in my head. I've had it in my head for 20 years. And every year, another part of it, and now it's like a series now, because obviously TV is the new film. And it's one of the biggest things. It all made complete sense and always has done. And we talk about stuff, and he said to me, Val's like, the album's so mind-blowing. Like, Ted's going to call like 8 p.m. and want to speak to you. And then this phone rings, and he passes me the phone. And it's, hey, goalies, Ted Turner here. Yeah, it's a great idea, man. Great project, man. I read the script with the opening scene with Val of this idea we got going on, and it's great. Great pleasure talking to you. And puts the phone down, and I'm like, the fuck is going on here? So Goldie, Wolverhampton, sitting here with Ted, you know, talking to Ted Turner, and Val Kilner's there. And it was a mental time for me, that stuff was. But I think no different than you think about these young kids now who are doing stuff and are meeting people, get flown to some place or whatever else.
Yeah.
But it was pre-internet.
You've just said so many things that I don't even know which one to pick out to ask about again, because you talked about a blood pact sitting on a rock in the Nevada desert. You spoke about spaceships taking off.
Yeah, I know.
There's so much in what you just said. I don't even know where to go.
I think I'll say one of the moments of an artist, when an artist, especially a black artist of black origin, that's so powerful and you're coming up.
Yeah.
It's Fish, the Fish. There's only one Fish, Lawrence Fishburne. We were in Paris. And I never knew this. We were doing what we were doing. It was crazy, man. And we were at Donatello Versace's mansion, and we're in this place in his bathroom. And he comes into this party. He comes in and he quiets in the room.
Let's paint this picture.
Paint the picture.
So Lawrence Fishburne walks in. What's he wearing? Is he wearing the Morpheus cape?
He's wearing a really beautifully dressed Versace thing that he's got. We've all been there. We've all got dressed and all this stuff. We do this fashion show. We come back to this mansion. Everyone's running around. I mean, there's things happening in this house of crime. It's crazy.
Sexual things?
No, just things.
Okay. Yeah.
Things. Yeah. Things happening. Anyway, it's just crazy. And I think at one point Naomi's having an argument with the dancer guy. She locked herself in the bathroom and he won't come out. He's sitting there banging the door. You're going, come on to the toilet. Whatever, crazy stuff. And Lawrence comes in and he takes the floor. And he starts reciting this stuff. This poetry, man, like, it's just the most powerful thing ever. And I'm like, after it's all gone, everyone's round of applause, and he says, great, it's amazing. And then I start talking to him. So what was that, man? He goes, you know what it is? It's prison poetry, man. My boy learned me this shit. This is from Philadelphia. It's a book, prison poetry, that I learned as a young man. My boy gave me this shit, and I recited it. I learned everything in this book. It's the beginning of rap for him. It was the beginning of the spoken word, prison poetry. Like, we're talking before, like, Lead Belly. Anyone of you, those of you don't know, Lead Belly. Yeah. Lead Belly was a young black man who played. You know this guy? Mm-hmm. He was played. They'd let him out of prison so he could perform, and they put him back in prison.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Oh, yeah, this powerful blues player. And he recited this poetry, right? And he said, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to send it to you. And he sent me the book. I lent it to someone, and that motherfucker never returned that book for me. It was a very personal gift to me.
Yeah.
But when the moments like that happen in my life, they always stay with me. They're very powerful moments.
Yeah.
It's not like some guy just says, yeah, I'll take a motor or take a car or have that, have his suit, have that, you know, have
it's
a
little
what.
Gift, it's memory, right?
It's the memory. And I think in all of this, especially now with film, we're going back to film. Let's not get off the track here. Le Haine, best film about a gun ever.
Listen, that's my favorite film of all time, genuinely. Vincent Cassell. The first time that he was on my radar, and it's incredible.
It's the best film. And also, did you know that it was all in colour and it was only the last day they changed it to sepia?
No, I didn't know that.
The director said, I want to do it, I'm not doing it in colour. They shot it all in colour as well. They made it sepia, yes. True point. And when you think about, you know, no disrespect to certain films being made about a gun, but that's a real film about a gun.
Yeah.
Because it follows, why do we have to be narrated to? But people think we're stupid. For all those of you that don't know, P.T. Anderson is a remarkable director, a phenomenon in his own right. I mean, Gondry's great, but Gondry can confuse people sometimes because you have to be very smart to understand. I think you've got to have certain smarts to do that. You know, some of the early Russian directors, but in terms of how Magnolia, which gave me the idea for the whole Timeless idea, because Magnolia is about crossing an avenue and the chance and circumstance of people meeting. The guy Green, Labyrinth and Green, is it? He falls from the window.
Yeah, yeah.
And the guy always loads the gun and shoots, and she misses and she shoots him and she gets charged for murder, but the gun wasn't loaded. And this time it was loaded. And this person committing suicide. All of the chance, you know, and Donnie the child star and all these things. So they really stuck with me. Like film noir has always stuck with me. You know, Canvas Confidential, which is, if any of you love Tarantino, Canvas Confidential is a black and white film noir, straight up, as simple as you like, but the cleverest of plots, you know. And all of these films, when I was put into a room as a kid, and just that's all you've got is that TV, man.
That's so interesting.
Do you think that for most people who are into the arts, that it's something, it's almost like a calling, like because what you're saying really resonates with me in terms of, like, I knew from five.
You knew, man.
I was 5 years old.
Wow.
Going to people's houses, because back then in the sort of late 70s, early 80s, people would have pianos in their house. So I'd be a kid and my hands would be like this on the piano. Like, I'd just be drawn to a piano. And then my parents were like, okay, we're going to put him in.
Do you play?
Yeah.
Do you know, I've got to say something.
What?
I don't want to change the story because I want to carry on with this. That's the fascination with looking what you're saying at now, why the resonation is there. I'm fascinated watching people play because I could never play. I just wanted to photograph it. Carry on.
Yeah, no, well, I'm the same. Like, I think for most people, there's a very, even when you're not consciously aware of why you're being pulled in that direction, you get pulled anyway. And then it becomes inevitable. Like, you couldn't be anything other than who you are.
No way.
Like, you couldn't be a 9-to-5er. Like, I've never worked a 9-to-5 in my life. And when I think about it, it's like, next month, I'm 42. I've been doing music as a full-time profession for 20 years.
Wow.
But, and I was having a conversation with someone yesterday, and I'm like, I can't imagine. Like, what's your plan B? What's your plan B?
I don't know.
I think, do you know what, Kev? You've hit on something there. I think that is a big one as well. Because when you're creative and when you're into doing music or art or film or whatever, you can't do anything else.
There is nothing else.
You're like, if this doesn't work,
I'm dead.
I'm fucked.
Well, I think you can, you know, the aspect of teaching or passing on the knowledge to someone else. At 42, I've got to say, that's the, you know, 40, I thought, you know, one grey hair on the bollocks. 52, eight. I'm like, it's, you know, I'll pull it out, five appear. You know, it changes dramatically, believe me.
Are you saying grey pubes are like gremlins?
They're like bad gremlins. Like, they really multiply bad.
Breed.
Yeah, breed. No, but you see, I think we need to understand is that the 40 to 45, the mortality is still quite virile, you know, it's still like strong. But for 45 to 50, the what should I do? And it's kind of like, a lot of people just go to church, right? And they go, you know, I'm going to church. Well, yeah, I'm going to go to the church of the arts because it's like American gods. We need the new gods now. We need the new, how can we pass this information on? So you being able to play, man, talk more about that.
Okay. So the playing thing is interesting because the teaching thing also is now connected to that. So now I've got people that are in their 20s who look up to me. And I'm like, I don't even think I'm anyone to look up to. But it's like, inevitably and naturally, you just get drawn to showing the next generation. And what happens is, and this is what I realised, all these guys like Max Martin and all these big producers, they do the same thing. They have young blood come in. What you have is the vision and knowing how to execute, which you can only get from experience.
Yeah, it's experience.
But the ideas that the youngsters have, because you get to a point where you get stagnant with your ideas. As in, you need to be inspired by...
You get fed by the young'uns as well.
Yeah, that's not what I'm saying. That's exactly what I'm saying. Right?
That's what you need to do. But I want to go back to the point with you, Reggie, as well, because I think I don't want to get far away from it. I think that's really beautiful about you saying about this, what we're talking about, this is the arts. The factual aspects of, because you're just real life we're dealing with right now. It's a real life thing where you've got to get people into the... The factual TV that you've gravitated towards as opposed to, like, the make-believe, if you like.
Yeah.
Because most people that were doing P.T. Anderson's of the world and this Lehane, it was factual because it was dealing with real life.
Yeah.
We just presented it in a set of things like that. I mean, this thing about me thinking that I'd failed or I did the wrong decision, right? What the fuck are we going to do next? What's plan B? You know, well, maybe I can turn to teaching. And that old 80s saying that goes, well, those that teach can't do. That's a lot of bollocks. It's like, that's like, you know, that's the worst thing you can do. I mean, you know, Clint Dyer went to Hollywood, came back and went, it's not me. You know, Idris might survive there and love it. I get it. It's good for if you want to be with that. There's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
But I think there's a dutifulness for us all to want to just be a bit. Just be dutiful, man.
Yes.
Just
that's
be
right
a
there.
Bit dutiful. I don't care if it's the best. Listen, pop music ain't easy to write.
No.
Not good.
Not easy.
It's the hardest.
It's one of the hardest things to do. Yeah. And my thing is just be able to put some heart and soul into it. That's all it is. But your factual stuff. There's so many people from the outside that were like, I'm not going to believe this because he's the guy that's in this middle class thing coming in to try and tell me about the gangs of South America. I want to see you on a stage doing telling this story because it's so much more believable. I'm so much more in touch with you. I'm so much more with seeing this brother who's a pianist that went through this thing that you might have been self-taught. A lot of people in my situation kind of self-taught. But it's interesting having a platform that I never... Did you think you were going to be doing this?
No, absolutely
not. I wouldn't have a clue. Even my art teacher, I said to him, come on, was you ever going to be... Did you ever think you were going to be doing this, Reggie? No. Did you ever think you were going to be doing this when you lot were together? And that's what we don't know. Mm. My 19-year-old's struggling right now because she doesn't know where to go. And I'm like, you just got to wait till something will come. It will come.
How does that creativity change and grow as you grow? So getting older, you spoke about being in your 30s and your 40s and your 50s. How does it change? I get the idea of wanting to share and wanting to mentor and wanting to teach, but expressing yourself is something you've done since you were a kid. So now you're in your...
52.
50s, I didn't want to assume. I'm glad you said it. Thank you for saving me. But now you're in your 50s. How does expressing yourself differ from when you were in your 20s or your 30s?
There is such an urgency to leave a legacy. Like, there's an urgency to... Game's up. I'm going to pass, and I go back to this quote. This moment right now, in this room, the mic's just been kicked. There's dust on the floor. Smell of an old house. There's a little bit of shade. This is real life. Heaven, that's the heaven right now. But the hell is not being able to remember it when I'm gone. But I'm not an atheist. Because whatever the capacity of belief is, I just feel that I've got to get a lot of shit ready in my kind of spiritual capacity.
So you're saying heaven is in the now?
Heaven's in the now. And this ain't about, you know, this isn't about, you know, we're going to die, we know it's going to call, we're going to die and it's going to be it, and we're going to be going to share. And this isn't about religion, it's not about that. You know, listen, if I'm going to sit a God in a candy chair when I die, sooner or later he's going to want to get up in that candy chair. If I'm going to burn in fucking hell, sooner or later that burning's going to stop hurting me. Because in the capacity of remembering it like that, for me, going back to the point, there's an urgency because this is the life that I remember. I don't hear about anything else. I'll cross that bridge when I get to it. Because all the would-have, could-have, should-have, assumptions of afterlife, it's a cop-out for not getting on with it right now. And that's why there's a lot of war right now.
So is it for you about urgency in terms of your mortality? Do you feel that your creativity has shifted?
Yeah, I feel like it's like I've got a lot of great things to do and I can't be arsed with all the chaff. I've got to get on with the wheat, straight wheat. Like I need to do Holst's Earth because he never did Earth. I need to paint, you know, 15 paintings of Bowie in all the different Bowies he was. I need to explore Black Mantras. I need to explore, you know, space travel and you know, in terms of how, you know, people were looked at in terms of Sun Ra, you know, and stuff like that. I just feel there's an urgency of knowing that. It's like you're obituary, seeing myself in the ground, well, being burnt, you know, because cremation is my thing, and knowing that everyone's going to be there. And there's an amazing book called David Eagleman. It's called Some. And it was given to me by Stephen Fry. And it's a book on tales of the afterlife. It's almost if you can imagine your life backwards. And I imagine my life like that, like I'm not here. Because I don't think I'm really here in that sense. I just feel there's a time to really... The urgency is, I want people to walk into a gallery and go, this is his work. This is his literal work. This is the stuff that he did on film and celluloid. This is some poetry he wrote when he was off his tits in 1997 and he wrote it on the back. Coked out of me nut. This is what I wrote. You know, and that's what it is. And I think that's the urgency. And also to do right by my family in terms of, I wasn't a father to my kids in the way I should have been. You know, I wasn't given the life tools. I brought up in the care system. No one told me how to act as a human being. You know, even when I had a record deal, I was fucking driving Ferraris around and, you know, some kid would look at me the wrong way and I want to fucking at him. It's like, what kind of idiot are you? So it's about realising that truth, really, I think, and that's what it is.
Has that urgency come with age? And the reason I ask that is because I became very aware of my mortality at quite a young age because my grandfather passed literally while I was in the house when I was 14. He literally said goodbye and went upstairs and passed away.
Wow.
And from that age, I've been very aware of how long I have. And since then, I've worked my ass off. I continue to work my ass off because I'm aware that I don't have forever to execute all of my ideas. Mortality is a strange conversation to have because none of us know how long we've got. And I won't go into too much detail, but Kev, being a very good friend of mine, mortality is something that I imagine is very much on your mind with the year that you've had.
Oh, yeah.
So just putting this to the room really more than anything, how does the way you express yourself change as you grow and become more aware of your mortality? Do you become more furious and more desperate to express yourself? Or do you feel that you're more finite and do less, but do it better?
I think the latter. Because I think when you're young, you're angry. And not necessarily angry in the sense of, it's more like you have a point to prove. And as you get older, you start to live with your idiosyncrasies and your bad points, and you become comfortable with yourself. So therefore, when you do put something out, and whatever form that may take, it's more considered. You made a point about wheat and chaff, which I can't
separate the wheat from the chaff.
That is like the thing.
So a few of them today, big booyah.
So it's a thing where you don't need to prove the older you get. It's more about, as you say, things like family, like the immediate things.
Mm.
Because I think in the wider sense, it's like, well, if someone criticised you 20 years ago, to your face, you might have it. Now, whatever.
Can't be bothered.
It's like, you've already left, what you've already done, or what you've already accomplished, it speaks for itself in its own, like, you don't have to say anything.
Mm. How about you, Us?
I feel like when you're younger, you have a kind of arrogance and confidence and you don't give a shit kind of attitude. And what you produce is brilliant because of that. So you kind of like put stuff out and you don't care about the reaction, which kind of like makes it better already. And when you get older, I think you go through a stage of worrying what it sounds like, what you're putting out, how it's going to be received. So you start off, you don't give a shit and it's brilliant and whatever you put out is good. And then you go through a stage of worrying what people think. And then now I've got to a stage where it's not what you think I'm going to say is like, oh, I don't care what people think. It's just that, is it good enough?
By your own standard, though.
Yeah.
No one else's.
When we're writing, there's no throwaway lines. Is it good enough to leave this room? Because if it's not, it's not leaving the room.
Yeah.
And that's for my personal, when I was young, put it out, don't care.
I've just never given a fuck about any of it.
Ever?
Ever. Because of the very genre of graffiti and in that aspect of like, it was always going to be the bastard child because I was the bastard child. It never really mattered to me.
Yeah, but that's what makes it so accessible and good in a weird way because you don't care. So it's out.
So, and I think just typical Virgo anal in terms of layers. I'm complex anyway, so I've got to make it complex. I have to. I can't make it simple.
Hidden.
Hidden. I mean, you know, Beethoven was great at it. He was fucking master at it. Master. You know, and even Miles Davis quoted him. I'm not fucking Miles Davis, believe me, and I'm certainly not a Beethoven. But by the way, just for the record, Beethoven was mixed race. Your mother was a Moor. People forget this. And, you know, and I think it's just that the idea of knowing that I will pass and the music will be, you know, Mother will be a tragic opera. If I'd put my clogs 5 years ago, hopefully, it would have been there then. I should have just hurried that process up and it would have been there already. Knowing that you're laying down, I'm laying down the art, so I have to lay it down. I've got my piece of that. And I say to some people, what train are we on? Because the last time I got on a carriage, I got Mad Mike sitting behind me. I got Lead Belly in the first carriage. I've got all of the black players from Miles Davis to Mingus all sitting in my carriage. Prince is opposite. He's doing all right. They're all behind because I'm in this line of heritage that is only a small part. I'm sitting on the floor in the carriage because the train's full of greats, mate. Believe me, I'm not on the carpet. I don't mind being on the carpet. Yeah. And these new people getting on the train, you rowdy little kids going, yeah, and this I'm crying. I'm sitting there going, yeah, fucking youngins. Yeah, we give fuck you lot. As long as they respect the train you're sitting on. Because that train of urban culture and where we've come from and heritage is so important, but so fucking disposed through because we think it's great because it's just downloadable. You can't download fucking art. The music's already been compromised, but you cannot. And I'll give you a great example of this. You know, going into a gallery, reading a fucking solid book, going into a gallery in the space between a painting, you can't download a painting. I went to the Tate and looked at that exhibition, Hard Man, seeing that this was done in 1963, the struggle of these people, you know, and listening.
Soul of a Nation.
The Soul of a Nation. I mean, you look at, and
great
also.
Exhibition. Amazing.
And also the fact of heritage that's important. That I'm not disposable. You know, and that's what the internet's done. It's made us think that we're disposable heroes. We're not disposable. And it's important that, you know, and I say to young people, man, close a laptop, man, for a minute. Give me a week, 2 weeks. What have you really, your whole life's in that phone. Fuck you got? Can you not do anything? What can you physically do as a human being? That's a bell effect happening right now, really.
I've always been intrigued by this notion that, at least in music, if there was a power cut for 3 months, what would happen to the music industry?
Seriously, done, innit? It's gone.
No, it wouldn't be gone.
The players, I'm talking about play. Real people who got to pick up teams and play.
And the reason I say that is because it's interesting to think about pre-internet or pre-electricity, how people made a living from the arts. And we've gone through this blip of the 20th century where basically we've had huge amounts of money made for not much effort. But now, because of the way we consume, being different... Because the way we consume is different now, we're kind of returning back to the pre-20th century way of doing things. So like you said, you can't substitute a gallery...
Sing for your supper.
Yeah, but you can't substitute a gallery for a digital representation on our iPad.
Yeah, you can't do it.
It just doesn't work. So these methods of expression, which have been there from the dawn of man, which were developed over hundreds and thousands of years, it's like the 20th century tried to divert it, and now it's kind of getting pulled back to how it always was. There's a certain purity in that integrity.
You look at it another way, look at like commercial music, how it's sold to us, it's a playlist. You couldn't get the hype up to go to that club to listen to that in the hood at 2 a.m, in the same way you could go, you know, Wiley's going to be there with Skepsis, and it's going to be there, and it's going to be Storms, and they're going to gravitate, and they're going to do that, because that'll be roadblock. Because that's what behind that culture of realness, of that being there, is a crucible that's full of the gold of all of the stock.
From before.
It's weighted.
Yep.
It's Beethoven's silent note. You know, when you look at the score of Beethoven, it's got a note crossed out. You think, what's that? It's just because he's just getting you ready for the note. That's like a man going, bass line, boom. You know, you got to put a bit of weight behind the note. And it's a true thing, that. But it's everything from, well, I'm not excusing white people here, because it's music of black origin. Talk about the blues here. Talk about people that are suffering in that situation. And what's been great about the noughties was where, on the 80s, especially the late 80s, where graffiti wasn't about just one particular colour. It was loads of different kinds of people in the same thing. So where does that leave us, really? Are we all going to be Debbie Downer or Derek Downer? It's about having physical places for people to be. I know lots of young people that ain't going to gravitate towards the South Bank. Fuck that. Because we've had my son is a great example. He lived on an estate called Firetown, Heathtown, Wolverhampton. He's now serving double life, aggravated murder on that estate. Outside of the estate, postcode kind of thing. But when you think about it, two mothers died in that event. A son died and my son threw his life away. I'll be 67 when he comes out of prison, right? Just look back from the crucible of that. Where did it all go wrong? Well, part to play in that was probably father tools. That's another thing aspect there. But let's look at a bigger picture of that. He had the junior school cut out of his estate. No funding. Just close the school. They close the community centre first, then they close the school. What do you think is going to happen? There's going to be a lot of young, angry people.
Yep.
And I think generally, this idea about how food has gone. I look at the shortage model. All of a sudden, I can go and get Brazilian jalapenos with a touch of taco. Why is it so acutely good that it sells? Because people want, there's something that they want is a demand for that good food, right? They're not eating Iceland. They're eating good food all of a sudden. But yeah, I know some people that's all they've got, the choice they have is to get fat and they're poor. How do they get obese when they're poor? Because there's nothing in the food. Mm. So something so dissimilar, so out of sync here, because within the community, especially when you look at Grenfell, don't open that can of worms with me. You know, one of the richest estates next door, one of the richest estates in the land, and this happens in this day and age, and you think about that, because the community is there, and the only thing that really works for people in prohibition times and times of blues and when shit like this happens is the community does it its fucking self. And the reason why I've been getting away with it for so long, they've been getting away with that. You know what? They'll sort themselves out.
Yeah.
That's what they do, innit? Let's not fund that. Let's change the fascia of this gaff. And it happens with everything. But yeah, within a private situation, within Samsung and iPhone, we can give you a new phone, you consume it, but you can't give us something. The government can't give us something that we need right now because of the latency I'm speaking about.
Okay.
So I think there needs to be, it's not just a pat on the back and let's go have a few wine and a few bits of drink and let's get a couple of black people on the board. It's actually about taking the speed camera money and putting your money where your mouth is.
Yeah.
You know, why aren't the youth clubs that have security on them, that have got the security on the nightclub, they're getting paid well time and a half or double time to work in a nightclub where people might want to go in there and get searched for your guns, but go in and have a good time. If you have a fight on the dance floor, unless you know you ain't getting shot and you ain't getting ironed out, have it out in the back then. There you go. Have a fight and it's done. Get out of your system.
Yeah.
But, you know, because when I was living in Miami and seeing going to Miami Nights Club and guys having a great time, great community, and just on the outskirts, man's getting shot up and dead up and whatever else. But you've got to think about it as the community. The community always tries to save itself. We always do that. But we need more. We need... It's down to the populace.
Listen, as someone who's seen so many generations of culture and so many eras of culture come and go, I think it's a fitting closing to just sort of get your take on where we are now and where you think it's headed. Because things now are, because of the internet and the influence of the internet on British culture particularly, things are different in a way that they've never been before.
Mm.
So where do you think we are and where do you see it going?
You see my tone 3 minutes ago, I was very high rated. So it just gets me, passion, runs coursing. Just calm it down a little bit. The reason why I put myself in Thailand is just for that very reason, because I just have to be away with myself and in another environment. I think one of the things for all you guys out there with Reggie's book is environment and going to Africa and seeing a different environment. It puts us into perspective.
Yep.
More school trips to take these urban kids. I'm just going to put it out there, guys, out there in this world right now. I've never seen a trip that takes, let's take 20 students from Peckham or any other area that's kind of seen as an area of Black denomination or an area where it's stacked up with lots of people have been thrown into this thing and it's a little bit troublesome. Let's take them to Brazil. Let's take them to see South Africa on the outskirts of the townships. Let's take them to somewhere where we'll bolt on Red Bull, we'll bolt on whoever else, and we'll get music people to go and do seminars and talk to those same people in those places. Why don't we go and get a Carla to go and, you know, because he does these things. He goes and talks to people. Why don't we see these different things? Because within the community, charity starts at home.
Yep.
You know, we're trying to do things with, you know, the South Bank and skating, for example, and graffiti. Why aren't there parkour courses around London where people go and use their energy and get part? And let's get due diligence in. Let's get some parkour guys in to train them over a span of 5 years. And you have to come every year, like a social worker visiting the environment. All these different things. The people that are kind of doing this stuff seem to have forgotten what it's like to be a youth. They just want to put it on paper. Like, they just seem to forget. And forgive me if I'm wrong for saying this, but people say, well, why do you become a social worker? You know what? I'll fucking lose my head. Because I wouldn't want to be walking into an estate underfunded and all this stuff. And I've got to go home and go, what, hard day at work, honey? Yeah, this kid's got nowhere to stay. There's no rooms in the psychiatric place because he's got mental illness. Mental illness for young urban people in the community is ignored.
Yeah.
And the last time I checked that speed cameras don't stop anyone speeding anymore. Because I'm still paying tickets. So, you know what I'm saying? I just feel that we've become this thing where it's all about the lottery ticket, a man getting rich and man's not putting the money back into the community in the way that it should be. And the latency of the bike chain, the reason why the bike chain comes off is because the ribbon that keeps getting wrapped around the cogs is what's making it come off. The bureaucracy, the red tape, it's bollocks.
So do you think that where we are now is going to affect directly culture and creativity for that next generation of musicians, of artists, of writers?
I think the bell effect's happening faster than we think. And I think, you know, the SL19's got to back the fuck up for a second and we've got to try and look at community ways. I looked at El Sistema, you know, which is in South America about these young people being funded. It's a crazy thing. Check it out. You know, for young people playing orchestras, you know, it's crazy. But we have to address what's going on now with young people in this country. Mm. And we need to create more kind of street universities almost.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Where the curriculum, hang on a minute, the last thing I checked, wasn't the thing called Steiner School here in the UK? Wasn't a thing where you could go to this school out in Burcombe and it's like for people that are a bit more out there. Mm. And aren't most of those people in Michael Caine go, then all these famous actors go there. Can we have a chance to go there for some people that are in the inner cities here?
Do it again, yeah.
Can't we try and create a programme that's not just for the gifted that have got money?
Mm.
Listen, I tried to put my daughter through private school in Northwood. It was all girls' school. She was never going to be a dentist. Do you know what I mean? So in terms of getting young people here to do stuff, I think we need more funding to do that. Mm.
Listen, I did not have any sort of inkling as to what direction this conversation would go in. And I'm really glad that I didn't try and steer it in any direction other than what actually naturally happened. It's been a pleasure and a privilege to have you on. And this isn't built to promote what people are doing or what they've got coming out. Mm. But genuinely, just based on this conversation alone, I implore you to not only check out Goldie's first book and hear how his life and his relationship with art and culture has had a massive influence on people like myself and so many others that are now making art and culture themselves, but also check out the new book, which is out now. It's called All Things Remembered, and I implore you to get it, all right? Listen, this has been Talk Stew, and it's been unlike any other Talk Stew, and that's the way I like it.
Really? Well, I'm glad I'm about to implore your pianist friend here. there's always an agenda with me, do you know what I mean? And that's it. So it's been fantastic, and I just want to wish you both the best. And Reggie, man, you're our champion. You really are. Like, you know when the man goes, "Yo, man," you go, "Yeah, I cannot keep going. You must keep going, my friend." You know, he's got to go. You know what I mean? You got to keep it going for the boys.
I think you might be my Yoda.
Yeah, I'm hoping I am.
I think you might have just become my Yoda.
Keep going, you must.
You learn, you must.
Podcast, you must.
Podcast, you must, Reggie. Do not be angry.
Anger leads to podcast.
Yeah.
Talk Stew is a Pixu the 5-7 Deezer production. For bonus content, download the Deezer app or go to Deezer.com. Deezer. Originals.